Today's episode is brought to you by DeSanto Propane. DeSanto Propane is four generations strong as a trustworthy family-owned business with unmatched customer service. Go online at DeSantoPropane.com for more info or call toll-free at 1-800-752-4574. Since 1937, the difference has been DeSanto Propane. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another edition of the Debrief Podcast. Josh Durso and Jackie Augustine here inside the FingerLakes1.com studio, breaking down the biggest headlines from the last few weeks here in the region. Jackie, we're almost to Eclipse Day.
I know, it's very exciting. I feel like that's the good news story of the year, right? I mean, weather permitting.
If it's sunny. That's,
it'll still be neat if it's cloudy, like, because everything's going to get dark, you know,
But...
Having witnessed a total solar eclipse before, my kids and I traveled on the train, like with a pizza. We were so sick of pizza by the end of this, to see the last North American total eclipse in 2017. I can't even explain it. Like, people need, if it is clear, people need to get out and see it. And there are plenty of eclipse glasses. Let me just put in a plug. I just have to, it's not like a financial plug, right? It's totally free. But a couple of our board members with Blueprint Geneva have organized this like eclipse access program with Rochester Museum and Science Center. So 3,000 pairs of glasses have gone out in the past 2 weeks. And then I know that there was some sponsorship through, I think, like Geneva Community Projects and Tom Burrell's insurance company to get them out to all the students at the Geneva schools. And then they're at the Y and at the library and the Welcome Center. And so people need to get a pair of eclipse glasses and be ready, because it is going to be amazing.
Yeah, whatever you do, don't just look at it without glasses.
Oh, goodness,
please.
Don't do that. Don't do that.
Okay, so here's one question I have about that, because I've been watching this really carefully. I've been watching coverage of the eclipse really carefully over the last couple months, and comparing it to some of the stories that I was able to find from 2017 in like North Carolina and that area, it seems like there's a lot more like urgency attached to coverage of this event. Like, Wayne County's like preemptively issuing a state of emergency.
Oh, okay.
They're planning on apparently like closing off certain access points to 104. And we're here. I'm seeing a lot of stories from law enforcement talking about, like, you know, don't travel if you don't have to that day, stay off the roads. We're going to be inundated. We're not going to be able to do the things we normally do. It feels almost a bit like the coverage is going to squelch the event itself. I guess it won't hamper it. I guess it probably won't hamper it that much if we are truly going to see like 500,000 people traveling into the region. But it's like that part of it has been really interesting to me, because it almost feels like the opposite of how it would normally be presented. Because it is like this truly like once in a lifetime, except for you, I mean, twice in a lifetime opportunity. But it's almost like, on one hand, you have all the tourism folks saying, prepare for this. There's going to be an influx of people. It's going to be a great opportunity. It's basically going to turn into kind of a long weekend because of when it's happening. And then on the other hand, you have public safety and some like local emergency officials coming out and saying, be really careful. It could things could really get dicey. Almost, I kind of compare it to the way people talk about a nor'easter.
Right.
And it just seems to like those two like contradicting forces seem very strange, because in all of the things that I read about 2017, I saw none of this. And this isn't like a New York State thing. I'm reading like stories about this basically the entire path this time around. That's the way it's being approached. Maybe it's just an abundance of caution.
I think it is, and hopefully things fall right there in the middle, right? That we get a good influx of visitors who are all joyful and happy and ready to spend money in local businesses, and then they safely travel home, right? But I don't know. I can say we went and viewed it in Nebraska, which I thought wouldn't be busy at all. And I was in like the largest crowd, and there was the longest traffic jam I've ever seen in my life. Everybody was in great spirits because all the radio stations were playing every sun-related song you could possibly think of, which are all great. I mean, they're great. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, and so I expect a similar kind of positive, lively atmosphere. I do hope people come and see it, and I hope we're able to really see it. But yeah, I think telling people to be safe and cautious on the roadways is a good idea because, you know, we're not used to seeing that many people come in. And we are, you know, you won't get totality in Ithaca, you won't get totality in Binghamton. Like, where are people from New York City going to go but up, you know, toward the Northeast somehow? So I, or, you know, Western New York. So I'm cautiously optimistic that it will be a great thing. And there's a ton of stuff going on. Like, I didn't realize, like, Scott LaFaro Jazz Festival is the same weekend.
Yeah.
You know, there's 5K, there's all this stuff going on. So there's a lot of stuff to do. And I hope people safely enjoy it and just have a wonderful eclipse experience.
And I do hope, and you saying what you just said kind of gives me a little bit of optimism. I hope the crowds live up to, I hope the influx of people coming in to the region lives up to some of the numbers that have been billed, because I know how many small businesses have been making plans to accommodate a mass influx of foot traffic to all of these communities. And if that, God forbid, did not live up to the billing, I feel like there would be a lot of frustration and a lot of like disappointment.
And that honestly might happen because it really is going to be weather dependent. I mean, there are people who travel to see these. I mean, I didn't, like, this was part of like a family trip. I haven't like traveled to see any others. But you know, this one's coming over my house.
You're a solar eclipse tourist. You're just traveling all over the country to find them.
This one came to me. So that's great. But really getting kind of caught up in that in 2017, there was a lot of chatter where people were like, oh, it's going to be cloudy here, let's change and go this place instead. Sure. So depending on the forecast, I would say, you know, the Friday before the event is really going to determine it. If we have partially cloudy or clear skies, I think a lot of people are coming here. If it says overcast, if we have a snowstorm, we're not going to get it. Yeah, I know.
Don't say snowstorm. Good.
Well, if I say we won't get any snow, then we will. So I have to at least leave the possibility open.
Okay. So yes, we're going to leave that optimistic. Yeah. We're optimistic. Mm-hmm. Let's shift gears and talk about some of the other news stories that we have to talk about today. First things first, Geneva. Quite an interesting week on the I guess we'd call it the economic front. Last 7 days, Geneva Movieplex 8 closing, and also simultaneously, I believe it was the same. That all happened the same week. The Geneva Duncan that was proposed on the Gateway plot, as it's been described, gets the final nod to go forward. Community reaction to both was very strong. Very interesting. I have some thoughts, but I want to hear what your take on all of that news is, kind of cumulatively, and where that leaves the city right now.
Well, I think both stories are unfortunate. I think, you know, I share everybody's disappointment about the closing of the movie theater because, I mean, it's a movie theater. It's like a thing to do. And I love the Smith Opera House, and I'm sure that they will gear up to show more movies. But I think with licensing rights, like, there's certain stuff they can't do. That you can't get the big openings. So that is a loss. And I understand that during the pandemic, a lot of people were already shifting to just watching stuff at home, and that became all the more prevalent and easier. But I still feel like the movie theater like served an important community purpose. And yeah, it's sad to see that go. But again, that's like a big corporate decision that the city, I don't hold the city at fault for that. The Dunkin' Donuts. That's a corporate decision I do fault the city for. That's something that the neighbors in the area were really strongly opposed to, but not listened to. It's something that businesses, small independent coffee shops, were not pleased about, and they weren't listened to. And it just seems like it's, again, gonna say it, comprehensive plan, right? Talks about nurturing small, entrepreneurial, sustainable, locally owned and driven businesses, and kind of eschewing or avoiding falling into the franchise trap and the corporate, you know, box store, not just because they are less responsible business partners in terms of like giving back to the community and being part of the community fabric, but also because the aesthetic, you know, there are lots of different kinds of Dunkin' Donuts. Go to Pittsford, other communities. There's lots of different Dunkin' Donuts. We are not getting their best design. And we could have standards, but Geneva's economic development attitude has returned to the way it was in the early 90s. Desperation, give us whatever you've got and we'll take it. And that doesn't serve us well. And I think that the sooner we can remind ourselves that Geneva's actually a quality destination with a lot to offer and could be on the upswing, then we'll see better decisions. But that Dunkin' Donuts is basically what all these planning documents said would set Geneva back. And the fact that it's being celebrated as a win shows just how far removed people making decisions are from economic realities about what makes a community gain momentum in the right direction or stay stuck in the wrong direction. So, a Dunkin' on a corner like that, I think, is a harbinger of things closing, not of more things opening in the future, unfortunately.
Yeah, when it comes to the Dunkin' development on that corner, I said it in the last time we did this podcast. I don't really understand how a drive-through is going to work at that corner on that property with everything that's going on in that area. But then again, I'm not part and parcel to any of the data or any of the information that city planning or city officials had to ultimately make that decision, right? That's just me kind of ballparking it based on things I've seen. I live very close to a Dunkin' Donuts. I live very, very close to a Dunkin' Donuts in Webster that sits on a state road, but that is in a village. And traffic there with far more space than the Geneva Dunkin', this Geneva Dunkin' will have, becomes an absolute nightmare in the morning, where drive-through traffic is coming out into the street, spilling into the state road, creating a lot of backups between 104 and what would most people would know as Empire or our main street in the village. That aside, I feel like, to your point, it was a matter of they took the option of the best available thing that was right in front of them right this second. Yeah. And didn't want to waste any more time, or that was the idea. We can't waste any more time leaving this plot empty. My response to that is, and it goes to your point, how does this fit in with the broader effort? What else? So if this is step one to develop this part of the city, what's step two? What does this lay the groundwork for? What is the city's next step to develop this portion of North and this area of the city? Which I think a lot of people would agree, there's a lot of opportunity. It's kind of ripe for development of all sorts, that part of the city. What's the next step? And making this decision, I can't really envision what the next logical step is, Because the best case scenario, in my mind, especially with a drive-through, is that this intersection with ample space and potentially is where the video store used to be across the street. Is that currently empty or is that currently occupied
it's
by someone?
It's half and half. There's a Domino's pizza there, and then the other section is for rent.
Okay.
But
so
it's a large storefront
with
could
a parking
be something
lot.
With a parking lot.
So it creates a scenario where it could become an unattractive space to do anything in terms of development based on the traffic implications of this one decision.
Yes.
If this intersection all of a sudden becomes a congested mess because the Dunkin' is in operation there, nothing against the person who's franchising it or whatever the case may be there, but that's something that I think the city should have been paying attention to or should have been thinking about and at least had a good answer for. I don't know if they tried to answer that question or if it wasn't even entertained or thought about or considered. But I look at all of these projects, whether they're approved or denied, whether it's housing, whether it's business, whatever the case may be, what's the next logical step? And if the answer is, oh, I don't know, I feel like in that case, you haven't done all of your due diligence.
Right.
Yeah,
and I think that's exactly the nature of the criticism that's reflected in all of these very sound planning and economic development studies that have been done and ignored, which is that you can't take a piecemeal approach. You mm-hmm. can't say this piece of land at a critical intersection, we should just put it out for whatever. Let's see what we get. Now, I will say, you know, when I say the city, I think it's important also, in fairness, to parse out who or what I'm actually talking about, because I think the staff take a lot of the brunt of this, and they're not, in this case, they're not actually the decision makers, right? All they can do is present what's come to them. They can't right. give it the thumbs up or the thumbs down. Now, I mean, they can talk about whether or not it coheres with existing plans and whether, you know, in what ways it might set the city back, but their input is only as good as the people who get to vote on it. So this was a complicated parcel where you had both the IDA and the LDC appointed by the former city council into this discussion about who owns it, who's going to develop it, who's going to clean it up, because, you know, it used to have sure. be a service station, so there's contamination there. And I think at that point, it was very clear that both entities were just sick of it, right? Like, it had been a headache.
Sure.
It had occupied a lot of their time. They wanted to dispose of it. And as property owners, in isolation, you can't really hold that against them.
No.
But as arms of Geneva's economic development team, I very much do hold it against them for allowing haste. Ooh, haste makes waste. There we go. Right, that's a saying for a reason, right? Letting a hasty choice really set up a long-term disadvantage. I mean, that locks that corner in to a certain, you know, you were asking about the aesthetics. You know, it is an economic aesthetic of a certain sort, and it is a visual aesthetic of a certain sort, neither of which serves the long-term city interest. And in this case, impatience just won out. And that, again, read any of those documents, the takeaway is we have impatiently disadvantaged ourselves time and time again, and we got to stop doing that.
So I'm going to slightly play devil's advocate.
Please.
Ever so slightly, because grocery store was one of the things mm-hmm. that I saw talked about extensively. I can count the number of truly local grocery stores right. that exist between Rochester and Syracuse on, I think, one hand. Truly local, not Tops, not Wegmans, right. not Aldi, not. And I think it was probably pretty clear to everybody involved that those entities weren't going to be interested in doing anything with that corner property, partly because I think it's too small. I think it's kind of a weird, It's kind of a weird property in that I think it's too small for that kind of solution, but also maybe just barely big enough for something like a Dunkin' Donuts. So I don't even know really what you know, calling it the gateway plot was kind of misleading in my mind. But I think when it comes to a lot of these, like, to play devil's advocate, I think when we're talking about a lot of these economic development goals, people need to there needs to be a level of acceptance of the reality that's been created in New York State at large, which is that it is very, very, if you wanted to open a local grocery store in Geneva, New York, tomorrow, and you were gifted the property, literally handed to it on a silver platter, the likelihood of that business being able to remain in operation for more than 6 months is probably almost zero. It's just not conducive. So that's the only argument, I guess, if I'm playing devil's advocate, to support something like a Dunkin' or corporate anything, is that those are the only things really that have been proven viable in a lot of communities. And yes, I understand there are going to be a lot of small business owners who say, Josh, you're completely wrong about that. I own a small business and I'm making it work. I understand there are exceptions, but it is not the standard. And in lieu of some major change in state policy, the conditions to operate a truly small, locally owned business are only worsening over in the years to come.
Agreed.
So it's that kind of thing that I think, it's that kind of framing that backs city councilors, planning folks, even people at the county level into these decisions that a lot of people oppose and ultimately feel like aren't the best for the community. But that's, again, this is where, you know, all of these hyper-local, smaller issues that we talk about, they're really state issues. They're really bigger, broader issues that need major change, systemic change, in order to make any headway, meaningful headway. And the next topic we're going to talk about is definitely in that lane. But it's tough. It's tough. I think, you know, the city could have been waiting another decade.
Well, before we go to the next topic, though, I do want to say something about this, because I'm not one of the people who said, don't do this Dunkin' because you have to put in a grocery store. That's not...
Totally understood.
I understand that that was, and if you talk to the residents of the neighborhood, a place to buy food is top of the list, or close to the top of the list, right? Affordable housing is probably the top of the list. But the point, I think, that seems to be missed in the argument that you're giving, the devil's advocate argument here, is that it wasn't an either or, right? It wasn't this false dilemma of we either build this or we have to hold out for a grocery store. These studies say, and we've actually seen it, this is what kind of boggles my mind. We have small food markets in Geneva operating right now, and they have moved over time to where certain residential characteristics have changed in terms of residential density, which tells us that the findings of the comprehensive plan are true. If you have the critical mass of mixed income housing in a particular set of blocks, the services, the supportive services that people are demanding, like access to a bodega or a small food market, those will follow. Instead, the city gets itself into this rigmarole where either we have to do one thing or we have to completely solve the problem this other way, and they don't trust the expertise of people who've been doing this their whole life, right? These planners who come in, and I understand consultants get a bad name, but let me just say, if you actually check the credentials of the people who did the comp plan, the full occupancy initiative for downtown, like, these are legit operations with good track records in other communities. Looking at that corner parcel as a way to reinvigorate the housing market in Ward 6 in a new way, to introduce some new housing concepts, would have been a much bigger win for the neighborhood? Because you talk about defining the community character. You talk about increasing demand that could support a small business enterprise. You talk about changing traffic patterns in a way that makes people look at the neighborhood a slightly different way than they've been experiencing it to date. Those are the things prescribed by the comprehensive plan, and it's basically like our current economic development team, which are these appointed members of these groups that are making all these decisions, are just like people who go to the doctor and are like, no, I'll just keep on keeping on with my bad habits. Like, I'm not going to change anything. I just don't understand it.
When you say food, because I can anticipate what the comments or questions are going to be from that. When you say food market, identify, like, what is in Geneva, what is an example of a like successful food market that is in that's currently operating?
Right. So right now on both, they just moved, an Exchange Street and Seneca Street now, and I guess people would refer to it as like the Mexican food market, because that's one of the names of the food market. But the idea is, if people are familiar with like a bodega concept, right? It's not a convenience store, although there are some convenience store items.
Sure.
There are also foodstuffs. Like, there are also frequent pantry items, you know, milks, eggs, cheese, stuff that people need in their everyday cooking, but it's tailored to what people living within a couple block area have said they need to be able to purchase quickly.
Right.
And that's a model I think that could work, and is kind of a middle ground that people aren't giving enough thought or discussion to. And again, if you talk to the owners of those markets, which I've had the good fortune to do, again, what is motivating their success and their choice of where to locate? It's what people have demanded who live within the foot traffic of that area. So something like that could have been successful on that corner as part of a housing development or some larger project, but you know, nobody's thinking that way right now, unfortunately. And I will say also, there was a study about grocery stores in Geneva which showed we can't support another grocery store right now, another full serve, the kind that you were mentioning.
Right.
We don't have both the space and the demand at the moment. But with better housing decisions, that would change.
What you're describing sort of sounds like a callback to, I guess, probably like my grandparents' generation, where there were basically, like, even in small towns like Seneca Falls, neighborhood grocery stores. They called them grocery stores, but they weren't grocery stores in the mass scale that we think of Wegmans or Tops or grocery stores like that. Yeah, it's interesting. And I think the bigger, to me, the thing that makes this debate so interesting is that this part of the city is so removed from pretty much all of the economic activity in the city, even though it does get a lot of quote-unquote traffic through that area. It's interesting. One other note on that, the movie theater thing, I know a lot of people feel strongly about, obviously, the cinema closing. Yes, to your point, the times have changed, and the economics of operating movie theater have changed in such a way since the pandemic that it's difficult to operate. They haven't, so Zurich or Zurich, I'm not sure which it is. I think it's Zurich.
Sure.
Connecticut-based company, I believe. They have not said why they are closing. I'd hazard a guess, since they operate around 8 or 9 other theaters, that physical condition of the plaza probably played into it. You know, that is a plaza that throughout my entire life, 30 plus years walking around, has never really been that great in terms of its physical condition. Mm-hmm. So probably that played into it. The economics of the movie business certainly played into it. You know, just a random anecdotal example, I guess, of how things have changed. The movie theater in Webster, where I live, offers basically Sunday services. Local church groups will literally hold Sunday services at the theater Just, it started during the pandemic, but to me, that's one of the examples of just how drastically the economy of running a theater business has, like, this is what they're having to resort to in order to keep themselves, you know, operational and keep the lights on. That's tough. And obviously, we've seen other things like, you know, alcohol being sold now in movie theaters. That's a change from the last 5 or 6 years. And, you know, just as much as, you know, the hundreds and hundreds of comments that I read on Facebook of people lamenting the closure of it, you know, I'd say, hey, if 50% of those folks were going to the movie theater regularly, it probably wouldn't have been closing. But what they probably were doing was going up to Victor and going to the movie theater at Eastview, or perhaps going to Syracuse and going to the movie theater at Destiny, where the experience was night and day different. A completely different viewing experience, a completely different comfort experience, the whole nine yards. And pricey just the same. Going to the movie theater is very expensive. So, you know, all of that stuff in totality, I think when something announces that it's closing, whether it's a restaurant, whether it's a movie theater, you immediately get this guttural reaction from folks which is that, oh, I can't believe this is happening. Our community is continuing on this downswing, but, you know, they don't participate as much as those types of statements would suggest they do in the economy around that. So everybody, you know, it's disappointing, but the writing's probably been on the wall for a bunch of years that this theater wasn't going to be around forever. I do think it poses an interesting challenge for communities like Geneva. Throughout this last election cycle, one of the things that I heard regularly was the lack of family-oriented things to do, not just in Geneva, but in Geneva, in Canandaigua, in Seneca Falls, and in virtually every community. And I think as we see more and more of these things erode away, you know, maybe you didn't go to the movie theater every weekend, but if you and your family went to the movie theater 4 times a year, that was probably a notable family thing that you did that's now gone, that now requires a 35 or 40 minute drive to Victor. And I think that is a challenge that every community needs to figure out how to address quickly, because families aren't going to choose to live in places where there aren't family-oriented things to do.
Right.
Plain and simple. So yeah, that's pretty much all I got on that. Let's talk a little bit about housing. So earlier this month, Governor Hochul announced the allocation of $260 million to support construction of 1,800 affordable housing units across New York State. Among a few of the projects that received funding, the Creekview Apartments in Canandaigua, they got $2.6 million to create 72 units. Olympia Terrace in Auburn, which received $7.8 million for slightly less, I think slightly fewer units, but it's a different type of development. This is one of those things where I think it's important for people to understand the scale of the housing crisis that we have across the board in New York right now, and probably everywhere, and the amount of money that was spent to create units. And I think in my mind, it really points to the challenge, and just, I'm not really sure how the state moves forward. $260 million to create 1,800 units. Mm-hmm. There are probably counties in upstate New York who are 1,800 units shy of even reaching an equilibrium where housing truly becomes affordable again. And this is the state's entire allocation on that front.
Yeah.
In my mind, it shows just how big the problem is and how it's going to take an approach that is so foreign to anything that's been proposed. This annual, I feel like every couple months I get a press release about, oh, $7.8 million going here, oh, $2.6 million going here, oh, $5 million going here, and, you know, 30 new units going online or 50 new units going online. That approach is never going to solve this problem. Right. Never. And I'm not sure anybody currently in elected office anywhere is willing to undertake the actual steps that would be necessary to truly fix this problem. And what I'm afraid is we are just going to continue doing this approach that we've done now. As long as I've worked in the news business, this has been the approach to how we fix things. We throw a couple million dollars here, a couple million dollars there, and never actually make any progress because the pace at which capitalism has allowed to spin this housing crisis out of control cannot be kept in check by a couple million here, a couple million there. Oh, a couple dozen units of affordable housing in Farmington. A few dozen more in Auburn. None of those things are going to keep up with the pace at which it's being run away from. And I just, I don't mean to run away on this topic, but like there needs to be a real system-wide change to how we do housing. Like the status quo just does not work, clearly.
I agree with you. I felt no reason to interject. I think what you just said is right on. The only thing in what you just said that I think maybe we would disagree on is that the way you described what won't work, which would be smaller measures. Now, I'm not talking about what just happened, because I agree with you that, you know, why are these self-contained affordable housing complexes so expensive? Well, they get put out in the middle of nowhere, then you got to put in all the infrastructure, that drives the cost right up.
Sure.
And again, I am opposed to warehousing poor people. It's just not a sustainable. Every economic study about economic mobility, what actually helps reduce a cycle of poverty, what actually helps people have a meaningful series of choices for their lives that don't lock them in to bad situations, talk about the need for mixed income neighborhoods. And yet, when there's an injection of money, it is for these standalone developments, which is a problem. So we're taking old ideas and throwing new money at it and expecting something to change. It will not. The money wasn't the only problem. The approach is the problem. So, but one of the things you were saying was that it can't be a little bit here and a little bit there to solve a big problem. And I disagree with that just a little bit, because a more sustainable approach would be more, and I hate to call it regulatory because everybody gets nervous when they hear regulations, but what I'm saying is look at the existing regulations, look at the zoning. We could substantially improve affordability in cities, towns, villages. This isn't as much a rural solution, although it could apply. In these villages, towns, and cities that have zoning that create these R1 districts, single family homes, no additions, no accessory units, no in-law apartments, no home business options, that is not sustainable. So if you could start tackling the regulatory landscape and actually allow people to start increasing housing density in their own neighborhood on their own dime. Like, do you know how many people who own a big single family home who would be willing to put in a rental unit or to have an in-law apartment or to otherwise have an accessory structure on a big lot and open up an opportunity for someone to have an affordable place to live? Like, that would happen. And they would be better maintained because you'd have the owner occupancy component. I understand people are like, well, that's a one-off. But that is the kind of systems change that's easy, quick, and affordable to at least get looking at this in a different way. But if you won't even take that first, and I don't mean you, but right, if these communities are so reluctant to even take that first step, because they're worried about who then moves into their neighborhood, that's what's doing us in. We can't think differently and embrace this mixed income concept. So we're like shackling ourselves to the idea that it's only going to come from big, standalone, nondescript properties in the middle of nowhere that have to be state-funded. The developers are happy, but how does that improve our community?
I don't disagree with any of it. My thing is just that at this point, we have reached a critical mass with the housing crisis. And okay, the word crisis gets thrown around too much.
Yeah, but it's real here.
It's real.
It's real.
It's real. And I think my problem isn't so much the type. Develop however you would like to develop if you're an individual community, I suppose, right? I don't have a problem with the types of development. My problem is with the scale at which we need to bring units online and how this approach just doesn't even come close to tapping it, to touching it. You know, when the governor unveiled her housing initiative last year that didn't get included in the budget,
yep.
It created this, like, I think it was a 10-year window, mm-hmm. right? And when my criticism of that was, that's too long.
Right.
You're going to lose, you know, you're going to lose a chunk of that population to other states where people can find affordable housing. And the other part of it is it almost flies in the face of the experience of, you know, I'll say Gen Z, millennials who have now been waiting 15 years or been waiting most of their lives to see some meaningful systemic change on the housing issue, and it just hasn't happened. So I don't know that, like, my criticism isn't like, I agree with the car-centric housing or apartment developments that we see a lot of times when we're talking about affordable housing and how they kind of get thrown out in the middle of nowhere. I can think of a few just near our office here, our studio here, that fit that category. But, you know, that is just I view that almost as one smaller component of the broader issue, which is just bringing as many units online as we can. I like the idea that you just proposed, the zoning change. It's something simple that a community as an individual can take. But there again, you're talking about something, best case scenario, that zoning change requires, what, 6 to 12 months of deliberation?
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, look, Geneva took 5 years.
Yeah, so, depending on the community.
And then we still didn't get there. But yeah,
And then after that, you're talking about, you know, 1 to perhaps 12 years before you truly reach a point where, like, we've brought enough units online where things have, quote unquote, equalized.
Okay, I've got a quicker one.
Okay.
I've got a quicker one.
Let's hear it.
So if zoning, best case scenario, is going to take a year or two, immediately, right, jurisdictions could opt into condos. We do not have condos. And again, you're going to say, well, that doesn't change the number of available units, but here's what it does. Part of the reason that people leave the area is not just that the rent is too high, right, which it is. That guy who had that as his campaign slogan was not wrong, right? He was a premonition. I mean, he was very wise. Okay, so, but the idea here is that people could justify paying a rent or a housing payment of that amount if they were building some equity, if they were getting something out of it. It's both a function of what the price point is and what the product is. So you could change that landscape right away by unlocking the ability to then actually be spending that monthly payment on buying something, which doesn't have to be a traditional single-family home, which is how we envision home ownership in this nation, right? Which is not going to happen for most people. Most people don't want that these days, and I don't blame them. As a homeowner, I don't want it either. But again, the idea is that, so I understand that the solution is create more units, but if we just create a bunch of out in a field somewhere, mow down the farmland, put in a bunch of apartments, that the rent's just going to go up, 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 up. Somebody's making money, but we aren't actually addressing what housing is supposed to address in a community, which is actual equity, economic viability, security, you know, stable family home base. We're not doing that. Even if you build a million apartments, you're still going to have an economic crisis, which the housing crisis is a symptom of.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, we agree.
Yeah, it goes back to there's all these different, just think of these different, like, they're anecdotal stories, but they're ones that I'm hearing over and over again. An example is the argument that, well, if a millennial can't afford to buy a house, they should move to a place where they can afford to buy a house. And the number one response and argument to that is, well, there aren't any jobs in those places where I can afford a house. Well, make jobs. And it's like this incredible, like, there's just constantly an answer to avoid just fixing the system. This is the housing system in this country is broken. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you want to say rents need to be capped or the system needs to be changed so that people are building equity in something that they're renting instead of the traditional owning a home, whatever. We need to fundamentally change how we do housing in this country, because we are now going to have 2 to 3 generations of people, because I'm not confident a fix is going to come in the next like 5 to 8 years. We're going to have 2 to 3 generations of people and a majority, an overwhelming majority of the U.S. population not able to access homeownership.
Right.
That is just not a tenable solution moving forward, either in the viability of small communities, i.e. like a lot of those around here. Mm-hmm. What's your tax base going to look like if all you have are a bunch of short-term rentals and rental properties?
Yep.
It ain't going to look good. And two, it's fundamentally opposite of what this country was based on. So that's just, you know, my observation, and we're about to talk about another housing-related issue. But my overall broader point is not that any of these individual solutions are bad. It's just that they don't hit the scale.
Yeah.
And it's
you have
such
to do all of them at once.
Literally.
Immediately.
Yes, literally. okay, so a couple weeks ago, we featured a story about a Wayne County homeowner in Arcadia, that's outside of Newark, whose property was assessed at $69,000. That's right, we're talking about assessments. That property, which had been assessed at $69,000 for a very long time, the homeowners were stunned to learn that their proposed new assessment was going up to $321,000. Another story we published a few weeks ago talked about the overall increase in assessments across Tompkins County, which had gone up roughly 20%. And I wanted to talk a bit about just assessments and how the process works, how communities go wrong with, you know, communicating the things. And before I start ranting again, I wanted to get your perspective, Jackie, because you've been in city government before. You've worked in this. Do you think that communities do a good job of explaining to people how the assessment process works? Because it seems like every time the cycle restarts, people are like going mad, and they're holding papers above their head, and they're screaming and yelling, and it's a recurring process. So do you think municipal entities do a good job of explaining like how it works? Is that maybe part of the issue?
No, and I guess I would say it's because a lot of elected officials don't know how it works. We don't have a lot of people spending a lot of time learning how government works to be able to then, I mean, if you're an elected official, your job is not to just to sit there and listen to people complain and then to repeat those complaints and ask someone to do something about it, right? Even though that tends to be the model we're seeing. Instead, like, you're supposed to be the conduit, goes both ways. There has to be reciprocity, right? Your constituents want to get good information from you, and you want to hear and engage with them and come up with good solutions and try to push those up the chain. So no, there's not good communication because elected officials right now, I think we're in a lull in terms of engagement and education of officials, right? Like, people are treating local office like a privilege. Like, I deserve this. I get to sit here and tell everybody I got this seat. And it's like, no, like, you're a public servant, like, do some work. So the work starts by understanding the process. So, I mean, you hear, I hate to keep picking on Geneva, but it's kind of an easy target. Now, thank goodness, on the Geneva City Council, you've got a former assessor who can straighten them out and tell them how it works and explain what equalization rate is and explain how appraisals and assessment are not the same thing. But market value can affect assessments in a certain way. And you, it's like, I want to say to them, please pay attention when someone who knows what they're talking about, i.e. the staff or former staff, say something about the job they are tasked with doing, right? Like, learn it. So
I would just say quickly, it feels unnecessarily complicated. The assessment process.
Well, lots of things in New York are unnecessarily complicated. I mean, I run a low-income tax clinic in Geneva, and the federal tax code is unnecessarily complicated. When it comes to money, people like to complicate things. So, true. But it's the system we're in right now. So I guess, you know, we gotta learn it. We gotta learn what it's about. So yes, when people hear their assessments are going up, they automatically think that their taxes are going up, which is usually how it works, but not for the reason people think. When your assessment goes up, the city, I hate to use this, the taxing jurisdiction gets an assessed value that increases. Then it has to decide on a tax levy, which is the budget, the amount of money that they're actually going to raise through taxes. That's a separate discussion. If a city or municipality or taxing jurisdiction spent the same amount of money from year to year, and everybody's assessments went way up, your tax rate should go way down.
Right.
Your tax bill would stay the same. But that's not the way it works, because the tax rates rarely go down, because the levies get higher as assessments increase, so the levies often increase, and then the tax rate could stay the same, but your tax bill will go up. Or your tax rate could go up, and your bill goes up.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been scouring, looking for examples of this, like egregious examples of this, where, you know, assessments went up, and all of a sudden, a municipality in the region was collecting a grossly increased amount of money, and I could not find one. I couldn't find an example. And I assume that that's because the reality is that most elected officials understand that even if assessments are allowed to increase by an exorbitant amount, what people think is a higher than acceptable amount, they can't just immediately turn around and, you know, try and collect 30% more than they did the year prior. What seems to happen in more cases than not, the first scenario you described, which is essentially maybe there's a slight increase in how much the city or the town or the village tries to collect, mm-hmm. but most people who own homes wind up paying the same or less in their annual tax bill. Again, that was just in the research I've been trying to find local examples.
Yeah, we should, I'd like to look at that with you, because usually when an assessment goes up, the tax rate will stay the same, mm-hmm. Which means that people's tax bills will go up, but not by the same proportion as their assessment
right.
has increased. But if, I mean, the it's an opportunity for a community to lower its tax rate, because it is taking in, I mean, depending on the jump, right?
Yeah.
But like, you know, like you were saying, if it goes up by 20%, then your tax levy doesn't need to grow 20%. So you
right.
could lower the tax rate. And that has happened a couple of times around here. But usually, and I think this is probably prudent planning, right? You keep your tax rate the same for that year, so that you maybe restore your fund balance, or, you know, do the things that you'd been stretching before to get yourself in some solid footing.
Yeah.
And that way you say there's been no tax rate increase, but there is still a tax increase,
it, yeah.
because that translates, the multiplier is more. people's assessments rarely go down. So, I mean, and you don't want people trying to get their assessments down, right? Like, you don't want people letting their front porch fall off the front of their house. That's not good economic development strategy. So you want to hit that balance where people understand that keeping their home up, investing in it, adding on to it, all of those things are still good, reasonable things to do without stifling that growth by making the taxes so high that people are like, I can't even breathe economically to get and even think about space to add on to this house or do anything that's going to tip the balance that's going to make me owe more going forward. So, sorry, that was like a long answer. I'm not aware of a lot of municipalities who don't see an increased collection right after an increased assessment.
Okay, so I guess one current example that's playing out right now and isn't final yet, so I didn't want to talk about it, but like this example I think rings true. In the city of Rochester, proposed assessments went out, and the city essentially said, if your assessment did not increase by more than 67%, you will not see a tangible increase in what you owe at the end of the year for your property taxes. And I guess that's kind of the point where I was trying to, I had been trying to find a community where people's tax bills noticeably went up by an egregious amount, what people thought was an egregious amount in the region. And it was hard. It was really hard to find.
This is kind of the first year I think we are going to see that happen.
Okay.
Because, you know, so for example, Geneva's full reassessment that's happening right now, if, you know, I don't want to get into kind of the nuts and bolts of like assessment because that's not my area of expertise. But I will just say when there is a full, there's citywide assessment, which is what Geneva's having right now, it is going to capture all of the activity in the past couple of years of these sales. So houses that were $89,000 that just sold for $350,000, those are going to impact the assessments of similar houses in the immediate area, right? So there are areas of the city that are going to see an increase. I'm predicting. I have not seen any
sure.
number. I don't
yeah,
know.
Yeah.
But that's what we're seeing in some of these other communities. If there is citywide such an expansion of value in that way, then it is the case that the city would be able to predict that they could either hold the tax rate the same or even reduce it a little bit
right.
and keep people's tax bills almost the same.
Yeah.
That still means the city would be realizing more revenue, though. It just wouldn't be at the same rate as if they kept, you know, going with the tax levy at the same rate that the assessment is increasing. It's a question. I mean, you're expanding the pie, so you have to kind of wait and see how far it gets before you start cutting into it.
Absolutely. And one of the things I'm curious about, and I made a couple notes here that I really wanted to touch on because I think they're both really important. Kind of people lose track of them. First, proposed assessments are not final assessments.
Right.
There is a process, and yes, it's complicated. It's a little confusing, I think, to the person who, you know, doesn't interact with government very often. But there's wherever you are, wherever you're watching or listening from, there is a process. Go to your town or village or city's website, and the process is most likely outlined right there. Honestly, it's probably on the proposed assessment that you got in the mail if you got one of those too. And that goes back to the point where I think a lot of municipalities struggle with properly educating the public on
yes.
the processes because they are complicated. The second, and I think this is probably the biggest reason why everyone needs to be engaged in this housing conversation, whether it's the last one we just had or this one. So often, homeowners are sitting these conversations out. And I mean in terms of like when it comes to increasing housing stock and things like that. And my message to those folks is pretty simple. Like, you can't have your cake and eat it too. Like, assessments are a reflection of the value in the market.
Mm-hmm.
And so often I hear people say, well, higher assessment is just going to cost me more money. It's just going to cost me more money at the end of the year. Sure, maybe, it might not. But it's also validation that your home could be sold for that much, and you have X amount of more equity in that home than you did when it was last assessed.
Right. You could if you get it reappraised.
Sure.
Right. Yes.
But like that is, to me, like that you have an asset that is, because of the realities, they're not great realities, but because of the realities of the housing market, they're true. Like these facts are true. Like assessments aren't just being willy-nilly like thrown around. Like somebody walks up to a house and goes, yeah, that looks like 320,000.
Yeah. No, like, it's
data driven.
Yeah.
Data driven. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I talked to before we came on here, I was talking about a friend who he and his wife moved into a community with low taxes here in the Finger Lakes in 2016 or 2017, and they lived through a couple assessments before moving because of work. And, you know, both times they fought their assessments down, and they were successful in both cases. Their assessments went up, but they didn't go up to the degree that they had originally asked. And afterward, we were talking shortly after he moved, and you know, he said to me, he goes, yeah, kind of felt like a jerk afterward because we wound up selling our house for $60,000 more than what the last top assessment was and what we thought the house could even possibly be worth. Right. You know, so you know, they had this asset that, and I understand not everybody wants to sell their home,
right?
But by owning a home, you have the right at any moment to sell it, to cash out. And your assessment needs to reflect if this is going, again, if this is how we're going to do housing in the United States, your assessment needs to reflect what your house could be sold for. Now, I think there are some egregious examples, like the one that we talked about in the beginning. You know, a $69,000 property suddenly being assessed for $321,000 in Arcadia, New York. That's kind of silly. To me, that's kind of silly. Maybe the data supports it, but I think there are some examples where, okay, there has to be a limit to how much it could possibly increase. You know, and at the end of the day, this is all just stuff that's like, you know, everybody needs to be engaged in the housing conversation. Every single person, because everybody has a stake in it.
Yeah.
You know, so many of those people don't want to have a conversation about affordable housing. But when their house becomes unaffordable,
right?
I mean, they don't want to talk about it.
And that's the thing. I wish we had more civic engagement, more understanding that people's own livelihoods rise and fall with the livelihoods of the people they share the community with. And there needs to be more awareness of that. And, you know, I hope that this city council, one thing that they could do, any elected official right now could do, would be to educate people about the process for objecting to your assessment. Because what I hear too often, and I heard it from an elected official the other day, someone was saying, oh, these assessments, you know, there have been some letters to the editor and stuff, we're about to get it. And it's like their only response was, well, fight it. That is not useful. And I, you know, the guidance I would give, and I, you know, this is why no political party wants to claim me, and that's good because I don't really want to be claimed, but you know, I am an equal opportunity suggestion giver because I don't care, like, you know, I'm about to have this column that I timed with assessments and you know, and the 100 days of the first council, and because someone's got to play the long game if no one else is, right? So I've tried to play out these columns to fall at certain times. And, you know, I've got three suggestions they could do right now to help people get through this kind of assessment issue. And I understand a criticism I get is, why help the other side, right? And this is part of the problem. In the same way that you're saying that there are some homeowners who don't participate in what's going on, they don't care about affordable housing because they're comfortable in their house, and then all of a sudden, they're hit with this high assessment and they want to get engaged. And you're like, well, where were you? Like, there's lots to be discussed that could help all of us, right? In the same way, I think the idea that this is partisan or that local government has to keep things from people, no way. Like, there are solutions out there, and everybody needs to get on board in pressing for them. And it would be helpful if elected officials found out, first educated themselves about assessments and what's the process for contesting your assessment, and then could give that to people in a way that wasn't trying to play on their anger or make a political point, but instead was just being helpful and saying, you know what, there's a way you could do it, but here are the rules. Because it doesn't serve anybody's interests well if you have a bunch of people who just come down waiving their assessments and get frustrated that it doesn't change. And that's kind of the political landscape that I'm seeing shape up, where you've got some elected officials that just want to say, yeah, you should be angry. Yeah, go say something about it. And they're just setting those people up to come down and not make a change and not get be effective, because there are rules and guidelines. So, you know, put together a fact sheet for your constituents about how to properly contest an assessment and be a resource for them, instead of just getting people riled up and then leaving them out there with no support.
And God forbid, put some numbers on that fact sheet that actually shows, okay, at current tax, under current circumstances, given what the right. city or the municipality is currently spending money on,
yep.
here is what you can expect to pay if X, Y, and Z scenarios are true. It just, yeah,
of course. Get scared. They say, oh, I have a 60% increase in my assessment. I'm going to have a 60% increase in right. my taxes. And yeah. it's like, no, that's not what that means. But we need people who can actually speak about that and know what they're talking about, because that's missing. Yeah. And you aren't going to get that kind of engagement that you're talking about and that's necessary until people are actually getting good, reliable information and not just sound bites and not just political jockeying for position.
Hey, high assessments are what you get when affordable housing isn't right. prioritized. Last topic for the day, Wolcott dissolution was overwhelmingly defeated. My two cents on this, and a couple of people emailed, asked us to talk about this. You know, my argument doesn't really change after seeing the results. You know, this is pretty much entirely attributed to the people who were proposing dissolution, not making a good enough argument for what dissolution was going to achieve in terms of future development. And I think if you go back and listen to anybody who's curious, go back and listen to the or watch the interview conversation I had with Matt Horn, who I think did a really good job of basically framing it like this. When you're going through dissolution, you almost need to put yourself in the seat of creating a new municipality entirely. Pretend you're starting from scratch and build a brand new community, because that's essentially what you're doing by dissolving. It's not just a matter of, well, we'll dissolve the village and all of our problems will be solved.
Right.
All of the development will come, all of the housing will come. Like, that's just not how it works. You need a plan. There's a lot of moving parts, and simply removing a layer of government won't fix anything or everything. So, and that's kind of, that's really it. Like, I, you know, a lot of people, I think, kind of made it personal in Wolcott, which I think frequently happens. I can think of the last three or four communities that dissolved in the region, Lyons, Macedon, and Seneca Falls. And there was a lot of personality mm-hmm. in it. Us versus them.
Well, that's what's happening in local government across the state, across the country, I guess. I mean, it's sad. We're losing sight of, like, actual public policy and just making it, like, a popularity thing.
Yeah. And it's interesting, because I put myself, like, I was opposed to the concept of dissolution in Wolcott because of the plan that was being discussed.
Or the lack of a plan.
Or the lack of a plan. But, like, right. I could have just as easily sat down and crafted a plan and an argument for it that I myself and probably other people would have said, oh yeah, that can work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nobody sat down and did that
right.
and pitched that to other residents in the village. And I think that's just, like, that's where you end up.
Yeah, and I guess my worry is that, like, I agree with you that, you know, it's a good thing it didn't pass, because they weren't ready. They didn't know what they were getting into. It wasn't necessarily properly motivated in terms of, again, talking about public policy. I'm not talking about the personalities. I'm just saying, public policy-wise, it wasn't fully fleshed out. It wasn't a well-considered idea. I do think more government consolidation, mergers, you know, cooperation, intermunicipal cooperation does need to happen. So I don't want like the Wolcott takeaway to be, oh, well, this could never work. But I think it is a reminder, if not a wake-up call, to people that simply, you know, we hear it in Geneva, let's just take over the town or dissolve or whatever. It's not that simple. If that solution would fix everything, it would have been done a long time ago. There needs to be, and I'm one of the people who said, like, yeah, we should just annex the town, which you can't just do, right? That's a tongue-in-cheek statement. I know the law. I understand that can't be done. But like you said, it's about thinking about local government services differently. And that requires a level of engagement and thought and understanding. I think that's the theme of today's talk that we're having, I think. I feel like people in elective office need to start learning the job and taking seriously what local government is, because you can only reach a solution if you actually know the details.
And that right there is where we're going to leave it, folks. Well said. That is going to do it for this edition of The Debrief. We'll be back soon with another episode. For more, head over to Spotify or Apple Podcasts, and remember to subscribe. For Jackie Augustine, I'm Josh Druso. We'll see you next time.